come to order, and I'll open the work session on 2108. Patrick, a little quick summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The committee heard House Bill 2108 on March 22nd. It allows the Division of Motor Vehicles of the Department to retain certain documents submitted by individuals at its offices in the course of administrating or enforcing the Motor Vehicle Code. It allows the Department to retain a document if it has reason to believe that it contains false or fictitious information, is counterfeit, or has been altered, was unlawfully or erroneously issued, or is presented by a person who is not in lawful possession of it. The bill requires the department to provide the individual with the reason the document is retained, the law enforcement agency to which the document will be sent at the time frame in which the person may contact the law enforcement agency concerning the document. The bill also stipulates that documents must be sent to the appropriate law enforcement agency within 2 days after it is retained. Attached to your packets is the Dash 4 amendments. I apologize, having got them this morning, or late Friday afternoon, I have not had time to include that in my summary. I believe the DMV is here and can speak to those amendments.
Okay. I think we'll start with Robin. Do you want to talk about this for just a minute, Robin?
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. We do have before you the Dash 4 amendments, which incorporates the Dash 2, the Dash 3, and in the Dash 4. The Dash 2 amendments gave DMV the statutory authority to retain documents presented by individuals attempting to assume a false identity if the documents are false or fictitious, counterfeit, altered, or issued in error. Only documents issued by a governmental agency in the United States will be confiscated with the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 also directs DMV to forward documents to law enforcement for further investigation and that customers will have due process to retrieve the documents if desired according to the property procedures of the law enforcement agency. The Dash 3 amendments incorporated a sunset for this law. With Section 3, it says Section 2 of this 2005 Act is repealed on January 2, 2010, and that was to come back to the legislature and give them an opportunity to hear about any problems that we had encountered, hopefully remedies to problems if there had been any, and to find out if this had been successful and to see what kind of success we'd had as far as confiscation of documents. Also, the Dash 4 then were in line 25, we have replaced the word forward and inserted deliver or cause to be delivered. In line 29, we have given ourselves 6 days instead of 2 days. The reason that we have done this is this was at the request of Representative Burley on behalf of some constituents that he had talked to. Forward is not quite as tight of a term, according to Ledge Counsel and our attorney, as the word delivered. And with delivered being much more something confining of a term to use, we've given ourselves 6 days so that we can hopefully, if we have an issue, we're going to try to maintain that two-day delivery policy, forwarding policy. But it takes into consideration if we have illness or we have a manager that's out, if we have circumstances due to weather or the powder that the Salem Post Office recently investigated that held up my personal mail for about 3 days, then we're still basically delivering within 6 days, and we're certainly going to shoot for that two-day benchmark. And I realize that we did not put language in statute to deal with the receipt that we have every intention of issuing. And I will state today that if that is something that this committee wants to see in statute, that we will certainly do that. The only reason we didn't is that we don't need authority to do that. With policy and implementation of this bill, we have more flexibility. It doesn't have anything to do with our intent not to follow through with that. We have every intent of issuing, if we confiscate a document from a person that is attempting to establish a false identity, that we will provide that customer with a receipt, and at a minimum, that receipt will include name and signature of the DMV employee who confiscated the documents, the reasons why the documents were confiscated, and how that person may contact the law enforcement agency with the documents to be sent, and copies of all documents confiscated will be included with that receipt. So with that, with me today also is Michael Ward, the field services manager, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Robin. Questions? I guess not. Now, you've stated on the record, I just want you to reaffirm it, that you will give a receipt.
Yes.
Those individuals.
Absolutely.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, we will be giving a receipt and work with, you know, community to develop the policy that governs that if there's something that needs to be amended or if it needs to be strengthened in any way.
Representative Gilman, in addition to the receipt, as Robert and I said, and copies of the documents that we confiscate, so they'll have both, the customer would have both those documents when they left the office.
Very good. Yeah,
and I just want to verify that when we talk about confiscation, we are only talking about confiscation of what I would call governmental documents, whether they're federal, state, or whatever. I know that a lot of times when people establish their residence, they can use everything from a power bill to a Costco card, and we're not talking about any of that.
Representative Gilman, Representative Sorry. Brunt, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
A U.S. Federal, state, county-issued documents.
Okay. Oh, yes, your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Michael Ward. I'm the field services manager for DMV.
Sorry. Chairman.
Yes.
Actually, that triggered a question because in the Dash 4 amendments, unless I'm missing something, where does it say that the only documents that may be confiscated are those that are government-issued documents?
111. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Chair Gilman.
I was missing that. Further question here, Mr. Chair. So, Robin, as you were working on these Dash 4 amendments, and I'm sure I don't know if we will or not since this isn't a public hearing, but the folks that you were working with on this, how do they feel about this at this point?
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, I'm assuming that they are still not happy with this. We have had some calls. They have some concerns about the receipt that I'm aware of not being in statute. And again, we'll put it in statute if we need to, but we have every intention of issuing that receipt. And copies of the documents.
Could you elaborate on what the purpose is of a sunset of something like this?
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, because of the concerns that we've heard, we are trying to be sensitive to those concerns, and we are going to come back in front of the legislature in 4 years and talk about what has happened, what has transpired, how many documents perhaps we've seized, you know, the success of this, if there's any indications that we've been effective in stopping any type of ID theft, or perhaps report that there's been a tapering off, because once we post signs stating that we're going to be confiscating documents, we do have an expectancy that we'll see less documents of that nature. So that's our intent.
Another poll. Sure.
Yeah. And I, Robin, I do appreciate including in this Dash 4, as you pointed out, I was the one that kept saying that, you know, the fact that DMV in the original language would forward this within 2 business days doesn't tell the person who had their document confiscated, you know, whether it's 48, 72 hours or 3 weeks, when can they go to law enforcement to start that process? So I think that by saying delivered or caused to be delivered means that they can expect it to be there within that period of time. However, I think 6 business days is a little bit long. I appreciate your arguments, but there's more to this equation than just DMV. There's the affected public that we need to take into account their needs and their concerns as well. I think 6 business days is perhaps a little bit too long.
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, we're trying to take into account 3-day holidays and, again, disruption in service if there is that, or disruption within an office, perhaps. perhaps a manager being absent or an illness for meetings, whatever. It's our intention to aim for two and just give ourselves a little bit of room there to deal with any consequences that might come up. And I also want to state that when we use the word deliver here or intend to deliver, we're not talking about hand delivery. We are talking about mailing, which is what we currently do today. So we will be utilizing the mail.
Representative Byer, do you have a question?
No.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrea?
Good afternoon. My name is Nargis Shadbey. I'm with the Oregon Law Center, and thanks for the opportunity to make some brief statements regarding House Bill 2108. I guess we have worked as part of the Latino Task Force with the DMV on a variety of issues regarding access of Latino community to the DMV. And we saw the original, before this draft was, it was in draft form, and we raised the concern that remains a concern to this day. And that is, once someone's document is taken, what due process safeguards is the DMV offering, whether it's draft form or its fourth version here? I see none. And that's what's the central concern here. I just want to point out for you and for the record, one of the documents that may be taken, and I suggest is going to be the one that's most often taken, is the permanent residency card. And we have raised this with the DMV, and I believe that people have testified before this committee before, but I think it's so important, that's why I'm raising it again. And I appreciate it. Just so you are aware of it, 8 U.S.C. section 1304, subsection E, indicates that an individual, an immigrant to this country, is supposed to be in possession, personal possession of registration or receipt card, or they would face penalties, penalties that may include up to 30 days in prison. Now, I don't know whether DMV has satisfied itself that issuing a copy of a permanent residency card to an immigrant is going to be satisfactory to ICE, the enforcement section of immigration. I don't know the answer to that. But if I had my permanent residency card taken away, I sure would want to know that. We share your concern about having the provisions regarding a receipt issued in the bill, in the law itself. That's essential. And we do share the concern about the length of time that one would have to wait before it even goes to law enforcement. And just one final note is that we're deeply troubled by the fact that it could be varying amounts of time depending on where that document is forwarded to. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Perhaps I'm misunderstanding the intent of DMV, but they wouldn't be taking a document that they didn't feel was illegal or where it was unauthentic. If they take a document, they've subjected it to their test of whether it's authentic and truly the vehicle that it's supposed to be, and which includes Social Security or the immigration paper. So if the immigration paper were authentic, I would imagine it would pass that test and it wouldn't be taken.
Representative Gilman, Representative Boone, I understand that the DMV personnel don't have an intention of taking documents that are legitimate. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that it will happen, and it has happened before. And it is the immigrant population, among others, who will suffer. And I understand that there is training, and perhaps training would continue. But I want to emphasize that there are a variety of immigration documents. There are a variety of documents that they will be looking at. And in addition to reviewing the legitimacy of the cards, the DMV personnel will now have to apply probable cause, which is a legal standard. And I'm sure Robin may want to comment on that. No, I'm sorry. Robin may too, but Andrea, sorry.
Further questions?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nargis, you were very, very clear about your claim that DMV has not offered what you would consider to be good due process safeguards. Do you have anything that you could offer us today that we might think about trying to get into this thing through amendments that would satisfy that concern? Something concrete.
One of the suggestions that I had was that a special magistrate or a hearings officer be charged with reviewing issues such as Representative Boone points out, if someone's document is legitimate and they simply want to bring their concerns forth and cannot wait the process that will be then assigned to law enforcement for, you know, they obviously have to do the investigation, the time involved in that. If there was an avenue set up so that, like I said, one special magistrate could review situations like that on a speedy process basis. And we're happy to talk to the DMV further about that if they will entertain it.
Are you suggesting that this special magistrate or hearings officer be in DMV as opposed to in the law enforcement judicial side of things?
That's what I'm suggesting.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, Andrew Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. Briefly, I appreciate also the committee's indulgence in letting us come back. This is an important issue to us. Representative Boone, I want to reiterate, I mean, I think what we're speaking of is those few, and we hope it's very few, but it's going to happen, whose documents are taken and they are legitimate legal documents. That's where we need the safeguards. We don't need safeguards for people who are committing the crimes, their documents are seized. It's for those few that slip through, and I really want to emphasize that's where we need to be looking in terms of those safeguards. As I spoke before, I mean, our concerns are partly, and I know this committee had a lot of different concerns, and partly they're addressed by the amendments to deliver instead of forward. That begins to address it, that 6 days, business days, including holidays, is, I calculate that could be 11 days of real days to a person before they even could have their documents there, before they even go to the location where the documents are, before they could trigger whatever process there is. And that brings me back to the process. I testified a great deal about my concerns on that, as did others. The committee had concerns. We heard from law enforcement, trust us, there's a process here. We've got these process. Committee charged that this be looked at. The only thing we've heard back today is that the process to law enforcement varies. There apparently is no, I can't find in statute a scheme. We're not talking about when law enforcement officers see something upon arrest. We're talking about when DMV turns over to someone in law enforcement agency documents. We've heard no assurances that it can be done quickly or easily. You've not even seen any example of what goes on in various jurisdictions. What's the real-life examples of what someone would have to do if they showed up at a police bureau? Would they be told there are certain hours that they must come back to? Could they call in a request that they want to challenge or they want a hearing or these are their legitimate documents? Do they have to physically show up there in person? At which point, what happens with the police bureau? What do they start doing? How long do they have? I can't answer that, and I'm not sure any of us can, because you have not been provided that kind of information that I think is crucial in making your assessment that addresses one of the major concerns we had and you all had, which is what process is due. We would hope it would be infrequently used, but we need to ensure that it is there. Finally, I mean, so you're sort of shooting blind on this. And finally, while I appreciate there's a sunset on that, this certainly was, I've not been in any discussions with DMV since we last discussed this bill. I've seen the dash threes a few days ago to try to work out anything. Sunset doesn't really address our concerns. And if they're saying the sunset allows them to come back in and tell you how it's working, well, how do they plan to monitor the individuals who leave DMV and are sent off to the police bureau or other places and find out what happens to them? You can find out how many they seized, and you can find out if it's reduced the amount, but you're not going to find out what really happened to the individuals who are affected. So with those concerns, and really the concern that I can't even tell you what the processes do to these folks, I would urge you to not proceed yet and to insist that we get some real understanding of real days in the lives of these people. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Close the work session on 2108. Open the work session on 2113.
Chair, thank you. House Bill 2113 heard first on March 16th. The bill deletes certain reporting requirements to the Department of Transportation and deletes certain required elements of the Department's accounting and budgetary systems. It transfers the preparation of the biennial vehicle flat fee study from the Department of Transportation to DAS. Provides a new definition for the terms modernization and preservation for the purpose of selecting projects to be funded with OTA bond revenue. Included in your packet, you'll find Dash 2 amendments. They require the department's proposed biennial budget, program budget, to include expenditures for each program or item specifically listed in the department's budget bills enacted during the preceding regular legislative session. Restores the requirement the department receive annual approval from, approval from Committee on Ways and Means or Emergency Board prior to acquiring real property, office buildings, and facilities, and restores the requirement for process and outcome evaluation. Motor red light services, deletes a requirement the Department of Administrative Service highway cost allocation study include appropriate level of fees set out in ORS 825-480, and restores a requirement that the department and the commission review flat fee rates. I believe we have the department here.
Who's coming? Oh, okay. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Mike Myers from the department. I'm here to answer any questions, or if you'd like to have me summarize elements of the bill, I'd be happy to do that, too.
For me, I don't need a summary, but if someone feels that they'd like Mike to go through these, I'll be happy to have him do it. I think you're lucked out. Now, questions.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Could I just perhaps ask on the Dash 2 for him to talk about the additional line 5. I'm not concerned about it. There must be a reason why you added that.
This is the, which one, pardon me, Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt?
On the Dash 2 amendments, I am looking at the right bill, aren't I?
Yes.
Where you added on the Dash 2 is line 5 to 8.
On lines 5 to 8.
Right.
That component is to make it clear that where we have expenditure limitation and we're reporting on in our program budget an expenditure limitation, we're going to do it on the basis of the prior session's Ways and Means approved limitation. And just to make that clear, Mr. Chair, the reason is that the prior wording in the bill listed what we would report on, and one of the problems was that it became aged and it's no longer accurate, and this will say that we report on what's in the most recent legislative session.
Further questions? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2113.
Representative Hunt moves the Dash 2 amendments to 2113. Discussion. Anyone opposed?
2s are incorporated.
Chair, I would move House Bill 2113 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hunt moves 2113 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Representative Thatcher, you're disappointing me today. All right, Mike, call the roll.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Burley?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Senator
Byer?
Aye.
Senator
Boone?
Aye.
Chair
Gellman? Aye. Motion carries. Who's going to carry this thing? You made all the motions.
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'll be sitting in the wings.
I'm down on you.
We'll open a work session on 2429. Patrick?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Hey, this is Bill. I was here for the first time. We heard this on the 13th of April. It revises the definitions and increases bonding amount related to operation of vehicle wrecking businesses, establishes civil penalties for specific violations, allows the department to refuse to issue a certificate, allows the department to issue duplicate certificates, establishes fees for supplemental certificates, original certificates, duplicate certificates, and renewal certificates. It authorizes the department to adopt rules to transition from a one-year to three-year renewal cycle. We have attached to the packet the Dash 2 amendments. The voluminous size of them is due primarily to the fact that they replace the term wrecker throughout statute with the term dismantler. The effective portions of this, I believe, that were discussed at the previous meeting are on lines 8 through 10 of page 1. That deal with, it says, after vehicles and certs that are stocked in the inventory of a business. The language there is designed to clarify that it's specific to dismantlers and not to dealers or repair facility. We have some people. Barbara Crest has a panel of people that are here to speak to the amendments and answer any questions.
Come on up, Barbara. I've seen all of you before.
We're back again. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Barbara Crest. I'm Executive Director of Northwest Automotive Trades Association. Joining me here today are Mary Ann Trout, Hillsborough Auto Wrecking, and Mark Forkum with LKQ Auto Parts. Also sitting right next to me is Bob Anderson, President of Northwest Automotive Trades Association. I'm here to talk to you today about House Bill 2429, including the Dash 2 amendments before you. I'm going to do a quick summary for you and then would welcome any questions you may have. House Bill 2429 will improve the licensing, record keeping, and other state requirements currently in place for the Oregon dismantler industry. It makes the auto dismantler certificate good for 3 years rather than the current 1 year, which we know will result in the streamlining of administrative time both for the auto dismantler and the Department of Motor Vehicles. To note, that's important for us is there is no increase in fees for the auto dismantler license. It currently is at $150 for 1 year. It will be $450 for 3 years. It requires auto dismantlers to hold a $10,000 bond, an increase from the current $2,000 bond, but still less than the $40,000 bond required for a vehicle dealer's license, which many auto dismantler folks have as well. This bill defines the type of records regulators need to identify those that are dismantling vehicles illegally. For instance, it spells out specific record-keeping requirements that assigns a stock number to all vehicles and identifies all major components sold with the vehicle identification number from which those parts were removed. It allows for civil fines of up to $1,000 for violations and up to $5,000 for anyone operating an automotive dismantling business without a certificate. Just for your information, so you have a framework, we currently have 269 what is called wrecker certificates in the state of Oregon. And finally, when House Bill 2429 was brought up and discussed at a recent DMV Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee meeting, there was unanimous support for the bill and no opposition voiced or noted within the group of auto dealers and auto dismantlers. With that, I'd like to hand it over to Bob Anderson, who has a couple of comments he'd like to share with you.
to actually, excuse me, Chair Gill and committee, thanks for having us here today. Our trade association really feels that HB 2429 is really critically important to the industry, the automotive industry, and to the environment. Since one or just about one out of every 10 people are directly or indirectly related to the automotive industry, the decisions that we make in regards to how our industry functions are critically important, not just to the environment, but to the economy of that industry as well. HB 2429 positively addresses both of these concerns. It sets an enforceable and consistent set of standards in terms of how business should be conducted in the automobile dismantling and recycling business while addressing that industry's best known environmental practices at the same time. As we've stated earlier in testimony, the environmental process that we put in place today in terms of how we recycle and deal with these automobiles will help us set a precedence in terms of how we deal with this in the future. And we really feel like since automobiles are aging as rapidly as they are, that this is really going to be a real big issue in the industry in terms of how we address it. So thank you very much, and I can ask any questions you may have.
Okay, Bob. I don't know if you stated your name either.
I'm sorry, did I not? I'm Bob Anderson. I'm the president of the Northwest Auto Trade Association.
Won't hurt to do it twice.
Good.
Questions? No? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'll entertain a motion to amend the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, I move dash two amendments to House Bill 2429.
Representative Thatcher moves the dash two amendments to 2429. Discussion? Objection? They're adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2429 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves 2429 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mike? Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. And Representative Thatcher, motion passes.
Sure.
You want to do it. Good. Okay, I'll open a work session on 2811.
House Bill 2811, first heard on April 4th, expands the type of equipment or devices that may not be used in a motor vehicle while in operation on the highway to include the image display devices such as televisions or DVD players if the equipment is located any point forward of the back of the driver's seat or is visible to the driver. Exemptions are provided for vehicle navigation equipment, equipment used in operation of the vehicle or the operation of a radio, sound system, or other systems of the vehicle. Equipment used to establish communication by phone is also, or radio is also exempt. Attached to your testimony, you have dash 6 and dash 7 amendments. I believe we can probably speak to either of those.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations from the City of Portland. First of all, I feel a bit like a zombie this afternoon. I thought this bill was pretty much dead, and it somehow has been resurrected, and I'm feeling resurrected at the moment here. I'll speak to the dash 6 and point out just a flaw that we just caught. The intent of this bill has all along been to try to modernize the existing statute that prohibits television screens from being viewable to a driver. With technological changes and affordability issues, digital disc players that display an image device have increasingly become a problem. We're trying to bring this bill up to the spirit of the existing law by including digital video disc players that can play an image viewable to a driver as being disallowed under statute. The DAS 6 amendment, we believe, captures the essence of the intent of what this bill was originally intended to do. However, we have captured a small error, and we'd like to point that out. On the DAS 6, line 3, under A, equipment capable of displaying a broadcasted image is far too broad than what we had intended. That would capture cell phones, GPS, a whole list of issues that we had never intended to get captured under this. We would respectfully request, if the committee is so inclined, to include one word that would substantially narrow this, and that is television, between the word A and broadcasted. That would define it as a television broadcasted image that is currently under the statute, and then we go on to capture DVD players. This has been a terribly painful bill for me, and I apologize humbly to the committee and would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Well, Mark, you're going to have to thank Representative Olson for the resurrection of this bill, but you may have just killed it again. You realize that, don't you?
I think that Representative Olson is aware of that as well. And again, I do apologize.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I have visited with Representative Olson on this bill since we had the first hearing and expressed my concerns with the original draft, how it went from a very narrowly focused exemption, if you will, or however you want to describe that, to something that was very broad. And I appreciate the efforts, and I think if we could work on this to get this one word back in there, I think this would really capture exactly what we're trying to do, and we can get this bill out.
It's very possible. We didn't move on one bill that I'd still like to get out of this committee, so I'm not closing the door, but amendments need to be forthcoming. Excuse me, Representative.
Did he touch on the dash sevens? Did he touch on the dash sevens?
The dash sevens, I thought.
Yeah.
We'll reopen the work session on 2811.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, Mark Landau with the Office of Government Relations. First of all, I'd just like to clarify two things. I did not work on the dash 6 or dash 7s. I do not have the 7s before me. I have read the 7s. Again, that amendment is overly broad at this point. We believe it brings in too much. The 6 is as focused as we've been trying to get it. Again, we're missing one word here that needs to be inserted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I close the work session on 2811 and open a work session on 3121. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3121 allows an authority to dispose of a vehicle with an appraised value of $500 or less at the request of a person who is in lawful possession of the vehicle. It allows a person holding valid record certificate or just mail certificate, this case may be, to tow and dispose of a vehicle appraised at $500 or less. It requires a person claiming a lien for the cost of removing, towing, or storage of a vehicle appraised at $500 or less to retain the vehicle for 15 days after the lien attaches before closing the lien. Attached to your testimony, let me point out testimony from Phil Stenbeck from the Douglas County Planning Department. He testified originally on the bill when it was first heard. He submitted testimony again, and also the dash one amendments, which are attached. And I believe we have somebody here who can speak to those.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Jillians, legislative aide to Representative Bob Jensen, House District 58. We actually had the opportunity to have a work group on House Bill 3126, at which the Douglas County Planning Commission was there, DMV, representatives of Oregon State Police, and several other groups, including the towing industry. And we realized that we were discussing a few of the same ORS code sections, and that 3121 and 3126 both dealt with abandoned vehicles. So that is why Representative Jensen had these amendments drafted, to make sure that we were handling the language the same in both bills. If you'll look at the amendments, the original draft of the bill had two blanks left in it. because when Legislative Council was drafting it, they weren't quite sure how many days were going to be included. That's on page 5 of the original bill. We talked with representatives from the tolling committee as well as Legislative Council and came up with a 15-day window. And if you have a copy of the original bill, you'll notice that that actually makes it uniform for vehicles under $1,000. Already in statute, vehicles from $1,000 to $500 have that 15-day, so it made sense that $500 and under. I think the reason Legislative Council left it blank was in case the towers wanted to go an even shorter period of time. They felt that 15 days was a fair period. The second issue that came up in our work group was the other issue addressed, which is that when the towers are sending notice for their lien sales, the intent of the statute is to either have it be, as it currently reads, registered or certified mail. It was brought to our attention that registered mail does not require the person to sign, so the intent of the statute actually is just to prove that these notices have in fact been mailed. And the vehicles, as it was explained to us, these vehicles that they're wrecking are worth very minimal, to say the least, and the added cost of certified or registered mail was an issue for the towing industry, and I'm sure they'd be willing to come up and talk to you about that. So it was brought to our attention that now the post office will actually give you a certificate of mailing on first-class mail so that these gentlemen could go into the post office and get the certificate for far cheaper, but it will still serve as proof that they, in fact, did mail the notice to the address provided by the DMV. And that is what the Dash 1 incorporates. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not real clear on this. If you take the Dash 1 amendment and apply it on page 5, line 24, we're still going to have registered mail as an option. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, that is correct. They can choose to either send it registered mail, certified, or now first-class mail with the certificate of mailing.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? No? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I will move the dash whatever it is, one amendment to House Bill 3121.
Representative Meyer moves the dash ones to 3121. Any discussion? Any opposition? Dash ones are approved.
Chair, I move House Bill 3121 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Byer moves 2131 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. 3121, thank you. I have trouble with those numbers every now. 3121 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Patrick.
Representative
Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Burley? Aye. Chair Gilman? Aye. Motion carries. Representative Byer. Okay, we'll open a public hearing and possible work session on 2017.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
House Bill 2017 directs the Department of Transportation to establish, by rule, procedures by which the department imposes or removes restriction on issuance of registration cards. Of course, that being said, the dash one amendments before you are a replacement of the original bill. What they do is they increase the time limit for motor vehicle dealers to perfect financial institution security interests in a newly purchased vehicle from 20 days to 30 days, and we have Daryl Fuller here who will be glad to speak to the committee about the amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. I actually hope you would ignore dash ones and look at the dash two amendments, which are exactly the same, except for the inclusion of an emergency clause. The dash ones are the same language. They do not include an emergency clause. Be happy for you to entertain either one of them. in the state of Oregon, somebody buys a car from a car dealer, and they obtain a loan to pay for the vehicle. Since we have all the loan documents in our office, the lender's often in other states and other places, so we have all the paperwork in our office that the customer signs. In order to perfect the customer's lien, or excuse me, the lender's lien on that vehicle, where they are actually the owner and the customer driving the vehicle is the secondary owner, in order to perfect the lender's lien or priority lien on that vehicle, we have to turn in the paperwork within 20 days to DMV. Often titles aren't available to us at the time we're selling vehicles because a lien holder already has the title, and so we're paying off the lien holder to obtain the title from the bank, and then we're selling it to another customer. So titles are often in transit, aren't available to us within 20 days. So the Department of Motor Vehicles has a document called a transitional ownership document, which we can use to perfect that lien when the title isn't available. Again, that has to be filed within 20 days. If that lien isn't perfected within 20 days, then the lender loses their priority if the customer were to file for bankruptcy within the first 90 days. Then the lender would become an unsecured creditor, the customer would get to keep the car, and the lender would be out the money. Except that the lenders have agreements with dealers that we're required to indemnify them if we don't perfect the lien within 20 days. So what happens if we don't perfect the lien within 20 days and the customer goes bankrupt within 90 days, the customer keeps the car, the bank says, hey, we're out the money, so the dealer is required to pay the bank. So the customer keeps the car and the car dealer gets to pay for it because the customer went bankrupt. And all that's current law. The U.S. Congress just passed and the President just signed a modification of the bankruptcy laws. You probably see it in the news. It changes that lien perfection time from 20 days to 30 days. It essentially gives the car dealer an extra 10 days to make sure all the paperwork gets filed on time to ensure that that lien is perfected for that lender on behalf of that purchaser. If this legislature chooses not to act on this legislation, then you will have state laws saying 20 days and federal laws saying 30 days, and it will create, I think, an enormous amount of confusion in a lot of people's minds on when the paperwork has to be filed in order to protect the lender in the case of an untimely bankruptcy within 90 days of the time of purchase. So all of this bill does is change that 20-day timetable, which used to mirror federal law, to a 30-day timetable, which will mirror the current federal law, which will go in effect on October 17th, which is why we got asked for the Dash-2 amendments, which actually created an effective date of October 17th, so that the state and federal laws will change at the exact same time. This will not affect any consumer unless that consumer buys a car, the dealer doesn't perfect the interest within 30 days, and the consumer files for bankruptcy within 90 days. Talking about a very small number of people this potentially could impact, and generally people who buy a car and file for bankruptcy within 90 days are those people who know they're going to file for bankruptcy, and they go out and buy a car and get some credit cards and do what they can to spend as much as they can prior to filing for bankruptcy. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thanks, Daryl. Questions? Pretty simple. I think we can do something with this.
Thank you. And again, it's the Dash 2 amendments, Mr. Chairman, would match the effective dates to October 17th. I'm really nervous about asking for emergency clauses because I don't like to consider much of anything an emergency, and I realize that raises a lot of people's attention on it. But on the other hand, if we don't attach an emergency clause, the federal change will go into effect October 17th. The state change won't be till January 1 of next year, so you'll have a period of 2 or 3 months where our national associations contacting the dealers and saying the rules have changed, and our state association will have to write them and say, no, they haven't changed yet. You have to wait until January, and there's just a likelihood of some confusion there, so we want to make sure that the Oregon and federal laws are connected so that they change at the same time.
Thank you. Anyone else to testify on 2017? Close the public hearing and open a work session on 2017.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2017.
Representative Groon moves the Dash 2 amendments to 2017. Any discussion? Any opposition? Motion carried.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2017 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Groon moves 2017 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll, please. Mike?
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Broom?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. You know, I think we could put this on the consent agenda. Mm-hmm. Representative Sam Broom moves.
Yes, sir.
Representative Broom moves that we place 2017 on the consent agenda. Any opposition? Motion carries. Okay. Now, we'll open a public hearing of 3467.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3467 allows for the reclassification of a public road or a portion of a public road as a restricted-use public road by resolution of a county governing body or upon petition by landowners whose property abuts the public road or portion thereof that is to be reclassified. And it also defines restricted-use public road for the purpose of the statute.
Thank you. Ron Finster.
Thank you, Chairman Gilman, and members of the committee, for hearing House Bill 3467 and giving me the opportunity to testify in support of it. I'm Ron Finster, Professor Emeritus in Economics of Western Oregon University of Monmouth. Taught economics there for 29 years. Obviously a teacher with all the handouts and so on. Got a packet of materials I've given you there to help clarify some of the points as I go over the testimony here. The top sheet, make it easier to look at than the House bill itself, is kind of an overview that I put together for the bill. If you just briefly tells you what it's about and the main features of the bill. Three general points I'd like to start out with. First of all, this is just a modest legislative step. This is not a earth-shattering legislative change. Shouldn't cause any major political uprisings. It's a new idea, so it may encounter some opposition by those who generally averse to changes in the status quo. But it does have significant beneficial effects, and I'd like to outline what they are in this testimony. This bill is especially beneficial for Oregon County governing bodies and agencies and for landowners. What does it do? The purpose. It creates a new class of public road, a restricted-use public road. In the present law, we have only two possibilities. You have a public road or a private road. And the problem that this limits the choices, both for the county governing agencies and for the landowners. If you have a public road, the public has all the rights, private has none. If you have a private road, the landowners have all their rights, public has none. This is a source of continuing friction in the community. If you talk to road officials, they'll tell you about this. This bill is designed to mitigate the problem. The overall benefit of the bill is that it increases options for counties and landowners, gives them greater choices, provides greater flexibility for county governing bodies and agencies in managing the county road system, adds a new road. So it gives them the opportunity to now have three possible choices. It makes possible political compromise, which can reduce friction in the community and reduce political pressures. With this House Bill 3467, neither the public nor the landowners gain or lose everything. It is a compromise. Now, what exactly is a restricted-use public road? If you look at the next sheet on your packet, number two, it tells you, first of all, I'll give you just a brief definition, working definition. Essentially, what a restricted public-use public road is, it's a public road which all levels of government and all those who need to use the road retain their full public rights of use. The general public is excluded from using the road without the landowner's permission. So that's what it is. It's important to note that a restricted use public road always dead ends. The next sheet in the packet there is amendments. One of the amendments is due to the fact that when the bill came back from Legislative Council, they had dropped one portion that we had originally had in there, which I think is important, so we put it back in. And then the second was a result of a discussion I had with road officials last week, in which some items came up that were of interest, and so I had included that in there as well. Now, the one amendment prevents the, well, it's page 1, line 10. This amendment prevents the reclassification of a slice of a public road. If you look at that sheet 4 under the amendment sheet, you'll see an outline or a description or a diagram of what I'm talking about there. That's what's accomplished. You cannot just take a slice of a public road. That would be disallowed by this law. So what it means is the restricted use public road always dead ends. Now, a key feature of 3467, and that's item number 4 on the overview sheet, the law specifies that the county's responsibilities remain unchanged in all respects. So as far as the county is concerned, it's exactly the same road before and after. It's a public road, everything's the same, with one exception. And that is, this restricted use public road will be administered as a local access road, subject to the provisions of ORS 368031. And you've got a copy of that in the packet, that ORS 368031. That explains in law what a county's responsibilities are for maintaining a local access road. So this new road, new classification, will be administered by the county as a local access road. Problems and benefits. As far as the county is concerned, both the county benefits and individual benefits, as far as the county is concerned, one of the major benefits is reduces friction in the community. If you talk to road officials, you'll find there's this continual battle going on between those that want to have a public road and those who don't want to have it. So we're trying to reduce that friction. It's a political compromise. Number two, there's a problem with confusion and pressure over road maintenance. Again, county officials constantly being plagued with phone calls of people, why don't you come out and maintain this road? Well, they're not responsible for maintaining local access roads. Now, what this law would do then, it would enable people to understand more clearly. If the landowners petition to change this to a restricted access road, then they will fully understand that, I see, this is as what the part of the definition of this road is, that the county is not required to maintain it. I understand. So it will reduce some of those phone calls and some of that harassment of county officials. I sound like a county road official. I'm arguing for the county road department. So landowners will be educated as to this thing. Another benefit to the county retains full public rights. So they haven't lost anything. They retain full public rights through the road. Another benefit to the county, they save money because they don't have to maintain this road now. And also they save money because the landowners assume some monitoring responsibilities for the road, both in terms of fire dangers and in terms of which I'll talk to later, and criminal activity. So a problem that counties encounter is that oftentimes there may be an individual, an intransigent individual, one or two, that refuses to cooperate with their neighbor in vacating road. You guys want to do it, not me. No way I want to do this. And this causes a lot of problems around the state. And it has given rise to complex solutions. For example, in Douglas County, because of this intransigent landowner, they've created a whole special road district. And they set up all their road commissioners and the whole thing just to get around this problem. Well, of course, HB 3467 would cut right through that because there wouldn't be any need for a landowner not to go along because he hasn't lost anything. He retains all this public rights. Now, as far as the landowners are concerned, some are their problems, which this 3467 addresses is designed to solve. problem number one, it's very hard to vacate a road. If you're a landowner, it's a very difficult thing to do. It's a time-consuming process, a lot of paperwork. If you look at the law, the county has to do a lot of research and have to have public hearings, the whole thing. So it's time-consuming and difficult. Also, 100% of landowners have to agree. 100%. Well, you know, try to get people to agree, 100% of people to agree on almost anything. It's pretty, very difficult to do to get 100% agreement. And also, there are some cases in which there are absentee landowners. People just aren't there to get involved in an agreement. So this law says two-thirds. We'll come down from that 100% and say that two-thirds have to agree. Also, it's very expensive to vacate a road. Polk County, it's $1,250 just to apply to vacate a road. Well, that's, you know, and then there's no guarantee it'll be vacated. In fact, the likelihood is it will not be vacated. So there's $1,250 just gone. And finally, the uncertainty. You just don't know. In general, it's very difficult to get a road vacated because, and why would that be? Well, because the county and the public loses all their rights, 100%. So they're not going to rush into this road vacating process. However, if the road is vacated, now we got a new problem. Again, the case of related by a county road official. In one case, and this, I forget which county now, but in one case, the landowners were successful in vacating road. Now they're involved in reciprocal easements. Now they have to give each other private easements over the road. So that's a big, they're going to involve a lot of attorney fees, legal fees, and so on. And so here we again. HB 3467 solves that problem. You don't get involved in that at all. It's just they retain all their public rights. So you don't have to worry about that. Another benefit, of course, to the landowners is they do retain all their public rights. All the landowners abutting the road do retain their full public rights. Another benefit to landowners, increased safety. There are two concerns of landowners out there. One is a fire dangers, and secondly, big time now, is criminal activity. The recent drought makes the fire danger ever greater out in these rural areas. And by restricting the public flow through this area, you cut down the possibilities of fires being started through careless activity, throwing away a cigarette or whatever it may be. So the landowner, with this law, will have some control over who's going up and down that road. And as a matter of fact, my neighbor, for one specific example, is petrified. She has a huge woods and very concerned about people coming back in there and starting that woods on fire. So she's very much in favor of this, to be able to have some of that control. Another example, teenagers out partying at night, and another property owner in Polk County, and they're very concerned about that. And then secondly, criminal activity. And this is getting... this is really getting worse and worse. Examples of meth labs being set up back in these roads, ransacking of homes that are often running, and finally, even as we know, just within the last week, even to the point of murder. It's getting very dangerous. Rural residents are increasingly worried about the dangers of living in these isolated areas accessed by public roads. So this bill would give these landowners some control over who's going up and down this this road. Also, for additional security, if they're off in these back areas, they could, this isn't part of the law or anything, but if the owners were to put a gate there, they could rig that electrically with an alarm so that in the middle of the night, if someone opens that gate, it could give them alarm. So what I'm saying is that it is very possible in this day and age that this bill could actually save someone's life. And finally, a benefit is privacy. Privacy, right. I mean, landowners, privacy, after all, is a highly valued economic good. And country land is expensive, and people pay a high price for the privacy that comes with that. There's no need for landowners to apologize for wanting increased privacy. So, unless there's a compelling public need for a public road across private land, then the landowner should be allowed to reclassify the road as a restricted-use public road. The general public in Oregon has ample opportunity to enjoy outdoor activities. There are millions of acres of public lands in the state of Oregon to which the public has a full right of use. In fact, some of the most beautiful places in all of Oregon have been set aside for government protection and for recreation. So restricting the general public's use of a few rural dead-end public roads will not cause a hardship for the general public.
Furthermore, the general public is not paying taxes for these restricted roads because the counties are not required to maintain the roads, not required to spend any tax money at all on these roads. So the public is not being deprived of the use of roads for which they're paying taxes. Now, some special features. Number one, an unlocked gate. This is item three on the overview sheet. Unlocked gate. The right of landowners to place an unlocked gate across the road is an essential component of the bill. The reasons? Number one, it is the most visible and effective way to alert the general public that they do not have an unrestricted right of use of this road. It facilitates the surveillance of the road by the landowners. Anyone brazen enough to open the gate and ignore the sign restricting public use is immediately suspect. I might note a side here. I don't want to take a lot of time on it, but I have heard that there has been some concern of firefighters, for having a gate. They don't like gates. And it's going to take me 10, 15 seconds to get off the fire truck and open the gate. Well, that may be a problem. However, these are rural areas. It's going to take the fire department 15, 25 minutes to get there in the first place. So another 15 seconds can make a whole lot of difference. Number two, there may never in the world be a fire there. The landowner may live there for 50, 60 years and be deprived of putting a gate there on the event that there might someday be a fire there, and we might have to get off the truck and take 15 extra seconds. Furthermore, if there's a fire on your property, you're going to be sure you're going to be down there opening the gate. So I don't think you have to worry too much about that. And finally, there's a trade-off. A cost savings of the prevention of just one fire with this gate is a trade-off with possible 15 seconds of extra time. So I think it's well worth the trade-off. Another part is no public hearing. There's another sheet on no public hearing. That's an important part of the bill. This bill says no public hearings. Why? Well, the goal is to make this reclassification process as simple and inexpensive as possible. The hearing is time-consuming and costly. So we're trying to keep it simple. Secondly, a hearing is really redundant and unnecessary because all those immediately and directly affected retain their full public rights. The general public would naturally be opposed for obvious reasons. So the objections are already known. I think people sometimes confuse a public hearing with public review. Yes, there should be public review, but that doesn't require public hearing. The county road officials do review all these petitions. So it has full public review, but it just doesn't have a public hearing, which, as I say, is just redundant anyway. Most importantly, though, no public hearing, because we have precedent in Oregon law. Right now, in Oregon law, a road can be vacated without a public hearing. And it shows on the sheet that you have in front of you there. It can be vacated. So, what is the concern of the county? Well, obviously, if you look at the current law on vacating road, obviously the concern of the county is of the landowners. Because they say, well, okay, if 100% of landowners agree, we don't need a public hearing. Okay, so, but look at this. If a group of landowners can result in not having a public hearing, when the public loses all of their rights, it seems to me that a majority of the state legislature ought to be able to not have a public hearing when the public doesn't even lose all of its rights. So, I think we have precedent for no public hearing. And just let me say it one more time, because I don't know if I said that correctly. In the vacating process, all the public rights of use are lost without a public hearing. Only the landowner's interests are protected. But with this bill, the landowner's interests are equally protected, while all the public rights of those who need to use the road are also protected. So the justification for no public hearing is greater for House Bill 3467 than for current law ORS 368 through 51. Another point. The petition says that unless a compelling public interest can be established by the county governing bodies, the road will be approved. It will not be. They have to present compelling interest for it to be denied. Now, what this does, this places the burden of proof on the county to show why the road should remain public.
But remember that a public road represents the continued taking of private property for public use. There should be a demonstrable public need for doing so. Our social, political, economic system is based on private property. The presumption is for private property, unless the state can demonstrate a public need for its taking for public use. In such a system as ours, the presumption is for private property. Landowners are not required to demonstrate a need for private property rights. HB 3467 reflects this American tradition. Thus, the county must and should be able to demonstrate a public need for the public road if they deny the landowner's petition for restoration of some of their rights to the road that passes over their property. Finally, getting there at the end. Why should this be state statute? Well, an important reason for that. On balance, Oregon counties gain from this bill. Counties lose none of their rights. For them, everything remains the same, except they're not required to maintain a restricted use public road. They also gain from landowners' aid in monitoring the road, thus reducing the fire danger, possible firefighting costs. Also, landowners aid in the control of criminal activity. So using state law, counties can realize all these benefits to themselves without having to deal with the political pressure from opponents. HB 3467 helps to mitigate the political frictions in Oregon counties without county government political involvement. Also, HB 3467 provides a modest, clean, simple, easy procedure for road reclassification. It provides statewide uniformity in the Oregon County road system, which facilitates efficient management and public understanding. And it avoids the confusion of 36 different ways of handling a common road problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron. Question?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Representative Groom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Fenster. Appreciate that. You and I met last week, and you satisfied most of my concerns regarding after we went through the detail by detail. The one concern, though, I do have, and it's just coincidental that it was your very last point, is and the question you and I talked about in my office as well, which is, why should the state be doing this? I hear what you're saying in regard to it's politically difficult for counties, but I'm not sure that's convincing on my part. In fact, it might be the opposite. I mean, I think counties need to hear the politics going behind this because there may be public interest on the other side. Do you want to care to address that?
Well, the only thing about that is that I would say, again, it goes back to 36 different ways of doing something, and when you have a simple solution to a common problem. In other words, this is not one county that faces the problem of confusion about road maintenance and all the things we talked about in terms of problems. They all face basically the same problem. They all get the same kind of phone calls and plagues and so on. So you're really solving 36 different people's sets of problems with one solution, which I think is a very effective and clean, efficient, neat solution. So that would be the thing that I would
kind of follow up. Just a little bit.
Sure.
I hear what you're saying. I definitely hear what you're saying. My problem is, however, that there are going to be, if the legislature acts carte blanche on this,
mm-hmm.
Folks that have legitimate issues in a given county are going to lose their vehicle, if you will, to raise those issues on a case-by-case basis.
I'm sorry. I didn't understand. Let me address that point. I don't think there's anything in this bill that restricts the counties from doing anything they want to do, basically. In other words, if this goes through and there's still all kinds of room for the county to negotiate and rearrange and pass ordinances and all kinds. Counties can do all kinds of things. Their position really doesn't change much at all, actually, when you look at the bill. That whatever the county was doing before the reclassification, they have full rights and everything to do after. So if they want to do something in addition to the law, there's no problem. In other words, the law doesn't restrict the county in any way. They can do almost anything they want yet. So if there's someone out there, for example, that has a special arrangement with their own county, doesn't change it at all. Wouldn't change it at all. It would stay exactly the same. Nothing changes as far as the county is concerned. So that's what I said at the beginning. The law is really a modest law. It's not a big earth-shaking, you know, change in the law. What it does, it really just opens up an opportunity for more to be done, not less to be done. It's not restricting anybody's rights. That's the whole idea. It's expanding their rights. So, no, in any county, if someone has a special arrangement in a county, something, that doesn't change at all. It wouldn't affect it at all.
Mr. Chair, but thank you. Yeah. But isn't it in effect potentially taking counties out of the equation? That's my concern. My concern is that if you as a property owner, or as you know, I were discussing my uncle's property owner, wants to circumvent the whole county process, they can do so, if I'm not mistaken, under this statute.
Under this?
Therefore losing that give and take within a given county and the concerns of local residents.
I don't see where this bill is resulting in the loss of anything.
Okay.
There's nothing lost here. That's what I'm saying. I don't see any loss at all here that I can see. I haven't seen any loss. Do you? I mean,
well, I don't know.
There's a pretty obvious one, yeah. Public access.
Oh, yeah, general public. No. I meant from the standpoint of the county. Yeah. I meant from the standpoint of the county, or from the standpoint of any arrangements that the county has, you know. Oh, yeah, right. Sure.
Well, yeah, just a quick close on this. Once again, it's not my county's not my worry necessarily. The problem is I feel that if you remove the county from the equation, then it's that person who may want to at least have a public hearing on why he or she thinks they should have access to this dead-end road. And I agree, it's going to be a hard case to sort of make. But if we do it here, they lose that ability on a county-by-county basis. That's my impression. You can respond to that if you want, but that's sort of my only reservation.
Lose the right to a public hearing?
I try to make this as just distill this down as much as possible. If you as a landowner,
right?
Joe as a landowner, this becomes statute. Joe as a landowner wants to close his road because it's a dead end road, it's a county road, but it doesn't go anywhere, and he now has statutory authority to do so. He can do so without really getting the county's approval to do that. I mean, the county, we lose the county as a vehicle for deliberation of this. Mm-hmm. And my point is that Joe's neighbor that lives, you know, a couple ranches away doesn't own the property, but may want to make a case why that person should have access to that road.
Yeah, but it doesn't take the county out of the equation, though. From your example, if you have a landowner, you have a road here, and the landowner says, hey, I'm going to close this road, he can't just do that with this law. I mean, this has to go through a whole process. This has to go through the county process. I mean, he has to petition. He can't just do it. He has to petition to do it. He has to go to the county officials and ask them whether they will approve this petition. Mm-hmm. So the county maintains, but they're not removed from the equation.
Okay.
No, they stay there. They stay right there. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't make myself clear on responding.
Well, you may have, and I...
Yeah.
Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I guess, you know, what I'm kind of struggling with this a little bit myself, too, because, you know, in the simplest case, if you have one landowner, and there's this, you know, public road, and we don't even want to get into that discussion on how it became designated a public road, but let's just stipulate that. So we've got this public road on one land. That person, that landowner, can go to the county by petition or whatever, mm-hmm. and say, "Look, I want to, you know, let's vacate this." Well, 368.351, as you point out in your handout, says that the county can vacate without a hearing if they have the signed approval of 100% of the landowners.
Right.
Now, you're suggesting with this bill that with only 2/3 of the landowners, we're going to do this without a public hearing. And excuse me, allow me to finish.
Yeah.
So, you know, here's my concern. Not only do you have the public that's using this road that's not going to have an opportunity to weigh in on it, but you've got 1/3 of the landowners that for whatever reason don't agree with this move, and they won't even have the opportunity to air their concerns at a public hearing. So that, you know, I'm trying to if it's just one landowner, it's a pretty simple case. But when you've got a handful of landowners, and I can think of a lot of these roads around where you've got dozens of them,
yeah.
I mean, this could turn into a real fiasco.
Yeah. The thing that I was thinking of in terms of the way the bill is structured, the concern was whether the landowners lose their rights. You know, if you vacate a road, then the landowners all lose their rights, their public rights. And, of course, there might be a few, one or two, that, hey, I don't want to lose my public rights. So with this bill, they don't lose any public rights. In other words, with this bill, the landowners, all the landowners, their position doesn't change at all.
Well, in fact,
they may not like it in the sense that, gee, my position doesn't change, but I don't like the fact that my position doesn't change.
Well, in fact, I would, first of all, I'm not sure when a private landowner what their public rights are, but I would actually submit under this the private landowner actually gains quite a bit because, for one thing, they're able to keep the public out by this non-locked gate. Right. And secondly, with your amendments, if this were to be adopted, where the county would manage these roads as a local road under 368031, right. It specifically states in there that the county governing body shall spend county monies on the local access road with some conditions. So if the landowners are going to get basically a private road that the county is going to be maintaining for them with an unlocked gate.
Well, but the county is not required to maintain those, and the county would only need to maintain them if there were some, you know, public reason for doing that.
But the purpose of your bill is that the counties and others need to have that public access for those for the county business that they need access to those properties.
If they decide that they need to do that, they're free to do that. They have they're not restricted from doing that. But what I'm hearing from most county officials, road officials, on is they would just as soon not have to do that. And that the local access law that I understand it says that they are not required to maintain these roads. I mean, that's how I...
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Kevin Westfall.
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman, members of the Transportation Committee. Kevin Westfall from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Spoke with Ron briefly on this, but want to convey that Oregon Cattlemen's Association is in support of HB 3467 for a few different reasons. We feel that this protects private property owners from needless vandalism and misuse of their property, which is we're getting more and more reports of this happening on a lot of these seldomly used roads. They're reporting from many instances of the MIP parties, trash buildup alongside the road or people just dumping trash in a particular spot, as well as increased concerns over fire danger, as well as the occasional drug user that is using these seldom traveled roads. We feel that by restricting some sort of access, it may well reduce the problems associated with these. We also feel that it could reduce the instances of trespassing on these public lands or on these private lands with a sign and or gate at the beginning of that road or somewhere on that road that is going to inform the public there is no public land access could potentially reduce the instances of trespassing on the private lands that's associated with those roads. As near as we can tell, this bill doesn't restrict any public officials on official business on these roads. They're free to go up and down the road as they feel free, as well as it reduces government costs from less and less maintenance on these roads, as well as less traffic means less repairs and maintenance. And I'd be happy to answer any questions any of you may have.
Questions?
No, guess not.
Art?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, we do not support the passage of House Bill 3467 for many of the same reasons that I heard the committee discussing in the last couple of minutes. The county public works officials has reviewed House Bill 3467, and they took an action to recommend that the bill not also be passed. Our concern centers around the question of, you know, we have a public road here with public access and public responsibility in terms of maintenance. If such a road is going to be limited in terms of access, then we really ought to be talking about converting this road from a public road to a private road. with the responsibility to maintain that road to the abutting property owners at this point and take it out of the public domain. This bill does not do that. We are also concerned the bill that actually does not provide an opportunity for public hearings. We feel that if something like this was going to be discussed by the county, it should be done in a public hearing format. So those are a couple of the major reasons why we cannot support the bill in the form that it is currently before you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Arne. Questions?
No. Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. This is just a logistical question. What is the process and how difficult is it to turn a non-used, if you will, dead-end public road into a private road? What's the process to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, it's a request to the county, and the county would review it and hold a hearing on it.
Is it a purchase as well?
Pardon me?
Would it be a transaction, excuse me, Mr. Chair, a transaction as well, a financial transaction?
That's potentially, yes. Depends on where the road came from to start with. If the road was dedicated from the abutting property owners, then it could be turned into a private road, and there would not be much a sale of the public right-of-way involved in that case. So it depends how that was. If the county acquired the right-of-way, paid for the right-of-way, then yes, then there may be a financial consideration involved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is converting to a private road the same as vacating, or is it a different process?
It's a little bit, Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, it is a little bit different process at this point. Yes.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thanks, Art.
Thank you.
Anyone else to testify on 3467? Close the public hearing on 3467. And, ladies and gentlemen, we did a lot of work today. Anything else to come before the committee? I think that would be a good idea, Patrick.
Members, we released an agenda this morning for the field trip to the Mexican consulate on Wednesday. Mike and I will be procuring a state van, probably, hopefully it won't be an Enterprise rent-a-van this time. Our committees have been doing that occasionally. But we will be getting a van to take members and other people who may wish to go. I think DMV is going to send somebody with us to the consulate for a tour. Tour will begin about 2 o'clock, so we're anticipating needing to leave about 12:30. We should be able to finish floor session. Hopefully floor session will end a little early so that members will have a chance to grab something to eat before we go. If we leave at 12:30, we should get up there with plenty of time, even given traffic concerns. Tour should last about an hour, so we'll be back down here by 4:30, we hope.
Where will this van be? Can we plan that out?
I think when we've taken road trips in the past, we've parked the van downstairs.
Oh, in the garage.
Right outside the publications room, which is room 49. We can do it there, or we can park it outside the elevators for the house wing. That's probably the best place to do it, since we don't have freight to upload this time. Maybe we could park right outside the house elevators. The van will be out there. Mike and or I will be out there waiting. And then members can arrive, and if Mike or I could get confirmation from everybody who's going, then we would know who to wait for and who not to wait for. And also, you'd be free to travel yourself. I'm going to provide directions and addresses to the members' offices tomorrow. We'll send a memo around to provide that. And Robin Freeman for DMV also provided some informational material she thought would be interesting to members about the process.
I'd really love to go, but I can't. Unfortunately, that's the day I have a lot of constituents coming in that afternoon that have been planning for quite a while. I really wish I could go. Sorry.
More consulate for the rest of us,
I guess. I would have. If I hadn't had that, and we, it's in several groups, so I'm sorry.
Sure. Understand. So James Asher, you're going to go in the van or inside of this?
I plan on the van.
You're going to go in the van?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, at this
point, I intend to, but I have some family issues. My father's in the hospital. I'll be out tomorrow, hopefully back on Wednesday, but I don't know for sure.
And I'll be going in the van. I'll have to check. I can go, but I just got to check to see if there's some other business. I might stay up there and do it.
Sure. I understand.
And I am likely not able to go at all.
Yeah, I'm in the likely not as well. In fact, Dave and I have an afternoon Veterans Affairs Committee that's been scheduled.
Good.
Dave is worse than
anything else?
No.
Meeting's adjourned.